10 years ago, Roy Scranton was a member of the United States Army in Iraq. Earlier this year, he returned to Baghdad, and he found a city in ruins as botched elections, sectarian violence, and chaos were overtaking the country. In an article called Back to Baghdad, Life in the City of Doom, he reflects on his time in Iraq a decade ago, his role as a U.S. serviceman in occupying Iraq, and what's happened since the United States left. His article appears in the July 31st issue of Rolling Stone. I'm very pleased to welcome Roy Scranton to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having me on.
You returned to Baghdad just a few months ago.
That's right. Was the
April
end
of this year?
That's right.
How much had the political situation in the country deteriorated by that point?
It was not great. It's not as bad as it is now.
Was ISIS already expanding its area of control?
Yes. They had taken Fallujah in January and had expanded into other northern provinces and even into the suburbs, western suburbs of Baghdad.
What did Baghdad feel like to you? Was it familiar?
It was uncanny. It was both very familiar and very different and strange at the same time.
You make it sound rather scary.
It was at first. Baghdad had been having several car bombs, sometimes several car bombs a week. There were killings, all kinds of different things going on. And I was going in for the first national elections since the U.S. military had left. So I had expected an increase in violence. And when I got there, all my old military reflexes just kicked in. And it was a very frightening place suddenly.
Well, you're tall, you're blonde. You must have stood out like a sore thumb.
Yes.
And you were going without insurance, without a bodyguard?
Yes. I was just going as a journalist, as a civilian. I had a translator. I had a fixer and a driver, but no security.
Did you have any plan if you were kidnapped?
No, I didn't know. I didn't have any idea what would happen. I kept in contact with the magazine, with Rolling Stone, and my editor, but there wasn't any kind of plan in place.
Is that the reason you went back, because you were on assignment?
I pitched the idea to Rolling Stone. I'd been wanting to go back, actually, for some years. It's something I'd been thinking about for a while now.
Did the city look quite different 10 years later?
No. It looked much the same. There were some differences. There were newer cars. There were malls open. That was new. There seemed to be more money around, more new restaurants open. But there was still trash all over a lot of the streets. There was still a lot of decayed and broken infrastructure. One notable thing is that there's this enormous mosque that Saddam Hussein had started building years and years ago, during the sanctions after the Persian Gulf War, it sort of fell into the construction fell by the wayside, and it's just this big chunk of concrete.
A Sunni mosque or a Shiite mosque? Saddam was Sunni.
Yeah, probably Sunni. But it was never finished under Saddam. It was never finished during the American occupation. It was never finished since the Americans left. It's just this same half-built building, enormous, sort of a monument to the ruin that Iraq has become.
The last time you were in Baghdad, you were on active duty in a war zone. Did you sometimes feel, well, I need to reload a weapon? I have to look out for snipers?
Yes.
Is there an IED over there?
Yes. The first 48 hours or so back, there was a high level of anxiety about roadside bombs and snipers and so on. It normalized into what I remembered as the sort of normal state when I was there before.
And you're right, the smell hit me as I stepped off the plane, oil, diesel, smog, and the whiff of sulfur. Late at night and early in the morning, when the air is cleanest, this is what Baghdad smells like. So it has a distinctly nasty smell to it?
it has a distinctly oil smell to it. There's a refinery on the south side of Baghdad, and there's a lot of smog, and so the city smells like oil.
My guest is Roy Scranton, who's written an article called Back to Baghdad, Life in the City of Doom. It's in the July 31st issue of Rolling Stone. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You describe having flashbacks of memories, including eating a Whopper while standing guard over blindfolded prisoners in a parking lot. Are there Burger King franchises in Baghdad?
There was. Now... there are sort of these knockoff franchises like Burger Queen and Pizza Hut.
Really?
Yes. But when I was there the first time in 2003-2004, there was a Burger...
Taco Bill?
I didn't see a Taco Bill, but I think that's a good idea. There was a Burger King at the airport at the American base. It was the first, I guess, American fast food there.
What other duties did you have in Baghdad when you were with the 1st Armored Division?
I was primarily a driver and rifleman. My job was field artillery. I was supposed to help shoot these giant rockets, but we got there after the war was over, quote unquote.
Well, after President Bush declared victory, but
right.
It was still early in the occupation, wasn't it?
It was. And in fact, through 2003, into the winter of 2004, we thought things were getting better. It wasn't until the Muqtada al-Sadr's Jaish al-Mahdi uprising in 2004 and uprisings in Fallujah that it really hit us that actually things weren't getting better at all.
You note that on your visit, U.S. military hardware was everywhere. Did we just leave that equipment behind, or did we sell it to the Iraqis?
We sold it to the Iraqis, largely. I think some of it may have been leftover processed, reprocessed equipment, but there's been a lot of military weapon sales and support for the Iraqi military.
Considering how things worked out, I was kind of surprised that you say many Iraqi soldiers even wear U.S. military fatigues.
Yes.
But no irony there?
No, not. I don't know. The Iraqi military doesn't have a uniform yet, and so it was somewhat funny. You'd see all different kinds of even American military uniforms, the early ones, the later ones, all different sorts of camouflage.
But can you spot somebody who is in the military easily?
Somebody an Iraqi who is in the military. Yes, they're usually decked out.
You did speak to one Iraqi, Mitag Walid, who was very hopeful about the country's future. What's his hope for Iraq, considering what's going on?
Talking to Mithak was a very interesting experience. He was middle class, from a mixed Sunni Shia family, and he was a college graduate. And he went on, when I talked to him, he was in school to be in the Foreign Service. And I couldn't tell whether his hope was grounded in positive change that he saw happening, or whether his hope was a kind of faith that things could improve. But he put a lot of stock in oil revenues and the slow process of political change and getting those revenues out to build infrastructure and schools and just rebuild the country.
In Rwanda, people were surprised initially at the genocide because there was so much intermarriage between Hutus and Tutsis, and yet suddenly the country was split. I'd assume there's a similar situation in Iraq, that Mithag wasn't the only half-Sunni, half-Shiite. And yet, the same sort of thing has happened. What, are those people in danger because they're not with either camp?
Yes. Yes, now and especially through the Civil War in 2005 to 2008, it's a really terrible situation.
Another man you spoke to, Nasir Hassan, said to you, "History has no conscience. If you're still alive, that's just because its foot hasn't stepped on you yet." Now, that is the opposite of the optimism of Mehtag. Is there a certain amount of nihilism among some Iraqis about what the future might hold?
I think so. Nasir is a special case. He's a poet and a philosopher. He translated Emily Dickinson and Schopenhauer. And he took a certain philosophical view on things and really, really thought about the situation. I don't know that I would say nihilism is the biggest problem or the most common reaction among people in Iraq. There's a lot of people that are working to make the future better or to try to hang on to what they've got. But then there's also a lot of people who are just trying to fight for their family or their people.
Is there a sense of panic or anxiety in Baghdad about the possibility that ISIS might arrive, although they're not calling themselves ISIS anymore?
When I was there, there was a lot of anxiety about ISIS and now that the Islamic State. In fact, during the election and after the election, the fact that there were so few bombings during that period made people even more anxious. They didn't trust the peace. They thought it was sort of the calm before the storm. And indeed, it turned out to be that. And from the people I've been talking to in Baghdad and Kurdistan recently, they're just as worried now, if not more.
You visited polling stations during those elections, including in Baghdad's most volatile neighborhoods. They just allowed you in?
No. Sometimes they did. I had to get accreditation through the Independent High Electoral Commission. But I was thrown out of two polling stations and not let into some others, even though I had the right through the accreditation to observe the voting.
Did voters want to speak to you? Were they open?
Some did. Mostly people seemed, voters seemed nervous and wary of speaking to me, but some did.
Did you get a sense of what they wanted out of the election?
The sense I got was that they wanted a change.
But they didn't get one.
No. Well,
is there a sense that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was fixing the election even then?
There was a distinct sense among voters that Maliki would win regardless of how the voting went.
Well, he had lost the 2010 election technically, didn't he?
That's right.
How was he able to stay in power?
In 2010, what happened was his party came in second in the number of votes, and after the results started to come in, he engaged in a series of shady practices, including working with the Independent High Electoral Commission to get some winning candidates disqualified, including putting pressure or asking and then putting pressure on the Iraqi Supreme Court to revise or reinterpret the Iraqi constitution, and even demanding a recount backed by the threat of military force.
And wasn't he aided by the United States?
He was. I mean, not directly in those moments, in those actions, but over the next 8 months, as the process went forward of determining who would be the prime minister and how the government would be formed, there was strong support from U.S. policymakers for Maliki.
You write, "The real story of the 2010 Iraqi election is how Iran and the United States worked together to ensure the continued rule of Iraq by a sectarian Shiite autocrat." What was it? Why was it in Iranian and U.S. interest to keep Maliki in charge? There must have been, there were other people who were offering to bridge the gap between Sunni and Shiite. Wouldn't they have been better?
I think so. Some other people think so. I think that the U.S. wasn't particularly interested in bridging that gap. I don't. Looking back over the U.S. participation in Iraq, the whole period.
Were we interested in keeping sectarian violence going there? Because Maliki obviously is exacerbating the situation by
yes.
his policies.
Well, the U.S. policies throughout the entire period supported sectarian division and violence from
the
very beginning.
It's only recently that the U.S. has changed that policy position?
It hasn't. It hasn't changed. I mean,
well, they've kind of suggested that Maliki should step down.
They have suggested that. And they have suggested that Maliki work and integrate Sunnis at the same time as they give the Iraqi government all kinds of weapons and don't engage with the Sunni tribal leaders who are working with the Islamic State now. It looks like, you know, throughout that entire period, a sort of policy of divide and rule. From the beginning, U.S. policy supported sectarian identity and sectarian division and sectarian politics in Iraq, sort of pitting Shia against Sunni again and again and again. When we went in, as a soldier, you know, I was a low-level soldier. I was a private, and we were told that the Sunnis were the bad guys.
Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and he had imposed minority rule over the Shiites, and there was a certain amount of resentment as a result.
That's true, but it's actually more complicated than that. There were plenty of Shia in government. There were plenty of Shia in the Ba'ath Party. In fact, the Ba'ath Party originated with Shia. What Saddam maintained a very, very strict sort of class disparity, and most of the poor in the country are Shia. Most of the country is Shia. And especially in the last few years of his reign, Saddam Hussein started to rely more and more on sectarian politics. But when we came in, we decided rather than to work against that, rather than to work with populist groups or work on integrating Sunni tribal leaders into the political process, we decided to perpetuate that sectarian split, but flip it the other way so that the Shia were on top.
Just as a foot soldier, were you aware of who might be Sunni and who might be Shiite?
No. You can't tell looking at people. I mean, even when I went back this time, Iraqis told me, you know, again and again I heard, you know, it used to not matter. We wouldn't even know who our neighbor was. You know, are they Shia? Are they Sunni? We wouldn't know. You know, part of that may be revisionist, but...
And now there's ethnic cleansing in various
areas. Yeah.
Roy Scranton's article, Back to Baghdad, Life in the City of Doom, is in the July 31st issue of Rolling Stone. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Roy Scranton. His article, Back to Baghdad, Life in the City of Doom, is in the July 31st issue of Rolling Stone. It was just announced today that the Kurdish politician Fouad Masoum has been named the new president of Iraq, a largely symbolic post. Should we take that as a sign that the country is still being held together and that a unity government with Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds is possible?
I suppose if you're an optimist. I don't think that the formation of a government around Baghdad at this point is gonna do much to outweigh what's happening in Anbar and Diyala in the north with ISIS, unless Maliki steps down.
Well, how much of this is also a proxy war? Because we have all of these other countries involved, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria.
Yes, it's...
And then, of course, multinational companies that have their own interests, oil companies especially.
That's right. There's a lot of interests in Iraq. It's the fifth largest proven oil reserves in the world. And, you know, there's Russian and Chinese oil companies involved, and a lot of Iraqis think that the war going on now is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
What do you think of proposals like the one Joe Biden made many years ago, in fact, when he was running for president, to partition the country along sectarian lines?
Biden's proposal was for a kind of federal state in which there's still a central government, but it's weak. And
it would be a Kurdish area, a Shiite area, and a Sunni area.
And that's one thing. I mean, it seems misguided in a certain way, and none of the Iraqis I talked to were in favor of it. I talked to one woman, Hanna Edouard, who is the head of an important NGO in Iraq, who recalled Biden's plan with certain disdain and contempt, and sort of saw it as a plan to partition Iraq and to keep Iraq weak. So a lot of Iraqis that I talked to saw the idea of partitioning the state as a way of keeping Iraq broken and crippled.
We've heard stories of the Iraqi military just dropping their weapons and their uniforms and running. But you describe running into Iraqi special forces and say they were kind of menacing.
They were. There's a lot of the Iraqi military, which is just sort of schlubby guys with AK-47s in old American camouflage.
But didn't we pour millions of dollars into training them?
We did. You might talk to your representatives about that. But there's Iraqi special forces, counterterrorism units, SWAT. There's an upper echelon of Iraqi forces that are sort of notorious for their brutality and their ease with violence.
Looking at the extremely volatile situation in Iraq today, has your assessment of the value of the U.S. mission in Iraq changed? You write that you've had to give up the illusion that we might have done some good in Iraq. We haven't done any good in Iraq?
I don't think we've done enough to in any way redeem or recuperate the vast amount of suffering and destruction we caused in the country.
What did you make of President Obama's commitment to sending military advisors back into Iraq?
I don't know what to say about that. It seems that it's certainly the least that he could do to help shore up Maliki's government.
Some people blame him for taking the military out too soon.
That sort of seems uninformed to me. The Status of Forces Agreement that Obama was working with was signed by Bush. And in many ways, Obama's policy was consistent with the policy in Iraq under the Bush administration. We'd been trying to get out of Iraq ever since we got there. You know, from almost day one, we were looking for the easy way out.
You had been a poet in Utah before you enlisted in the military?
That's right. I mean, a sort of amateur poet. I thought I was a poet.
You, on this recent visit, you met with a number of artists and writers in Iraq. Did that give you a connection?
It did. And so did, I'm working on a PhD now, and I talked with professors and students, and sort of the interest in literature and philosophy did give me a connection.
You met a sculptor who made art out of melted down American brass and was routinely threatened by fundamentalists. Is it hard for an artist to make art these days?
It's very hard. The situation seems dire there. A lot of the poets and artists I talked to were very pessimistic about the situation, and found it hard to continue their work. I talked to one gallery owner, Haider Hashim, who runs the Akkad Art Gallery in Karada, and he's told me that his gallery is one of two now in the city, whereas before the American invasion, there were 50.
Is it dangerous to make art in Iraq? In Afghanistan, when the Taliban were in power, they banned pretty much everything, music, dance, etc. Is there a pop culture that still exists in Baghdad?
It is dangerous to make art in Iraq today, and it's getting more so as this sectarian violence increases again, and the sort of the religious fundamentalism takes over. There are, you know, the only place I got to hear live music was in a nightclub that was just for very wealthy Iraqis, but for most people, art, music, literature, these things are being choked out.
And the museums were looted, so
yeah,
there isn't much to see. You also note that academic life has taken a turn for the worse in the country, that classes and content are now constrained by religious pressures.
Yes.
Is Shiite, is Maliki behind that, or is this something that's being imposed by individual groups who are freelancing?
The impression I was given by the university professors I talked to was that it's not official Iraqi government policy, but there is increasing and increasingly extreme pressure from various primarily Shiite religious groups in Baghdad to restrict what's on the syllabus and to not teach things that are too that are too risky or challenge the idea of
the God, way, you know. The way it is often portrayed in the American press is that the Shiites who had been oppressed are now the good guys. The Sunnis who were the oppressors and are the bad guys. And of course, the Islamic State is a Sunni group. Can we say that there's equal blame to be spread around here?
I think to look at Iraq and to see it divided into two groups or three groups is simplistic. We can't really do that.
There aren't many Christians still around, are there?
No, there are very few Christians left in Baghdad from what I understand, and there was recently this Christians being chased out of the north. Yeah.
By the Islamic State.
Right.
You spoke with a lot of people in Baghdad. Did most of them want to get out of the country, the ones who could envision doing that?
Most did. There were a few notable exceptions, but most of the Iraqis I talked to wanted to leave, especially the young people.
How far can you get on an Iraqi passport?
Not very far. There's a few places to go, and apparently flights out of Baghdad lately have gotten prohibitively expensive.
You write, quote, "The politicians who ran the war had shown no higher ideals than robbery and plunder, and I've been nothing but their thug," talking about your own experience as a soldier. You feel shame and disgust at having been an American soldier. But you weren't the one who deceived the public about weapons of mass destruction. You were just doing a job.
That's right. I was doing a job, but it was a job.
Are you
that
being
I...
a little hard on yourself?
It was a job I signed up for, and it was a job I chose to do.
Was it in response to 9/11, so many people who entered the military?
It was in part a response to 9/11. I felt that the world had changed around me, and I didn't understand it anymore in the simpler ways that I had before. And I wanted to see what it meant to be an American out where the American empire was made and defended.
Even at the height of the war in 2006, most Americans couldn't find Iraq on the map. What about today? Do you think that most Americans aren't even aware of what goes on in Iraq, although every once in a while there's a headline that says 100 people killed by a suicide bomber in a market in Baghdad?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not something most people pay that much attention to.
Did we lose the war in Iraq?
If we went to Iraq to make things better, if we went to Iraq for any kind of ideals of freedom or democracy, then yes, we lost.
Do you think it's likely that the that ISIS, or whatever we want to call it, will make it all the way down to Baghdad?
There are rumors, recent rumors, that they may be planning an attack soon, but I don't know about that. I can't substantiate that. One of the Iraqis I talked to predicted that ISIS would be in Baghdad soon.
Roy Scranton's article, Back to Baghdad, Life in the City of Doom, is in the July 31st issue of Rolling Stone. Roy, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad that you came back safely.
Thanks.